This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So here at Jikoji, we have just finished a seven-day sesshin, loosely translated as retreat, called Tanjue around the Buddha's birthday. And today I'll be reflecting on the Buddha's gifts and how we might use them. I have to say that, you know, this mouth has done a lot of talking this week. And it seems like, you know, where are the words going to come from? But the spirit is still there. So we'll see. We'll see. Before I forget, speaking of Buddha's birthday, we're going to have a birthday celebration this afternoon at 2 o'clock, if you would care to stay. Down in the courtyard, we'll do a baby Buddha ceremony at 2 o'clock, which will be followed by tea and sweets. So if you care to join us for that, you're quite welcome. The theme of our sesshin this week has been intimate. And I sort of loosely tied it to a koan. It goes like this. Two monks are talking to each other, Dizong and Fayan. Dizong asked Fayan, "Where are you going?" And Fayan said, "Around on pilgrimage." Dizong said, "What is the purpose of pilgrimage?" And Fayan said, "I don't know." And Dizong said, "Not knowing, most intimate." And so the question that comes to me from this koan is, what is this not knowing, and what gets in the way of intimate? And then I'll share this line from Andrew Olinsky, a Buddhist scholar and the former executive director of the Insight Meditation Center in Barre, Massachusetts. Meditation teaches us the value of every moment's unique experience. You have never taken in this particular lungful of air before and will never do so again. This particular step, with its lifting, moving, and placing phases, is absolutely special when you choose to attend to it carefully with your awareness. So, you know, shortly after the Buddha was born, his mother died. His mother died shortly after childbirth. And I wonder about that and how that affected his decisions. Right about then, too, his father was told, this child is either going to be a great political leader or a great spiritual leader. And so, in his late adolescence, early adulthood, you know, he had a pretty secluded life, if you will, a good life, early life. His so-called adoptive mother was his aunt Pajapati, right? And so he had a good life as a little kid, but there's still that trauma of separation from birth mother at birth. And I wonder about that because, you know, at one point in time he left his family's compound and he went outside it and he saw sick people. He saw old people and he saw dead people. And I wonder if not, you know, this is not in his conscious awareness, but how that, you know, that early trauma affected how he perceived this, how he took it in. If it had been otherwise for him, would he have taken it in that way, and the way he did? He wanted to get to the bottom of this, what he saw, suffering. Sickness, old age, and death. So he went off, He went off on some quests. He studied with one yoga master and became quite adept at that. And he was invited to stay on to teach. And he said, no, he kept on looking. He hadn't found it yet. So he went to another yoga master. Same thing. He became quite adept at the yoga practice, was asked to teach, but he left. And then he went into this really severe ascetic practice where he nearly starved himself to death. And I wonder about that move, that saying, did in his desire to get to the root of suffering, did he inflict it upon himself? Is that what was going on there? He almost died. Until he remember he had this memory from childhood, and he was sitting under a tree during the fall harvest. His father was taking part in the fall harvest, and the Buddha remembered that as a boy feeling such immense joy. And it wasn't a conditioned joy, a joy based on circumstances. It was just there. And he decided, well, that kind of joy is okay. Okay. And then he encountered this young lady who helped, who fed him and helped bring him back. And then he sat under the Bodhi tree. But this experience was different than his previous experiences. In his yoga practice, his practice was to this, going for realizing this one-pointedness and just this nothingness, which he did. But then he, and that seems to be a goal in a lot of our practice today is the special things, the special space experience. But each time that he did that, he realized that he was right at the back where he started in his quest for the root of suffering, how to deal with suffering. And so now he just sat. And that's our practice today. We just sit. Now, mind you, when he started then at that point in time, he'd had this yoga practice behind him with this concentration practices. So, it seems a little bit different for us when we come in, and we come in from the business, our world, our lives, and we come into sitting. It's maybe a little bit different for us than it was for him. But it was this grounding that he had that enabled him to see. It said it was through the night. I've read other things. It was maybe a little longer. Let's say through the night. And he went through the four stages of jhana, the four stages of concentration, and seeing increasingly into himself. So what did he see? What we call this vipassana insight. What was his insights? Well, he saw that all things are empty. And what does that mean? That sounds pretty solid, doesn't it? All things are empty. Well, he first of all, when he saw into, and this was so, for me, so beautiful. He saw that he focused on five things. His focus was five things only, and he taught from those five things. Form, head, body, brain, the human system, feelings. And by feelings, he meant, is this experience pleasant, unpleasant, or neither? And then perceptions, how the system perceives what it's experiencing. And then he saw, impulses or formations, or habit formations, and then consciousness. So the system as it experiences. I call my definition of mindfulness is awareness of the conditioned being's response to experience. And so he saw, there's this experiencing, there's this form that experiences, and it's always experience. That switch is always on. And he saw that, the first registration is pleasant or unpleasant or neither. And he also saw, that neither is an interesting thing because, okay. Oh, no big deal, how the system registers that, no big deal. But that's also a point of curiosity. Why are we bored by it? Why do we, why aren't we paying attention to that? And then perception, how do I perceive, how does this system perceive what's being experienced, what's coming in? And then the impulses of the proliferation. What are the narrative? What are the mind narratives? What are the mind states arising around this? And for all of this to happen, there has to be consciousness. That has to be there. He saw there that, and this is, this is an amazing thing there. In there is the creation in this mix, in these dynamics of form, feelings, perceptions, impulses, consciousness, in that dance of systems in us, these five systems, these energy patterns, is the creation of self, the idea of self. So, let's talk about this suffering thing. I've heard over the years, some teachers dancing around that word suffering. Well, it really means disease, it doesn't really mean suffering. Some squeamishness around that. Well, let's look at it honestly. Remember, old age, sickness, and death, loss. The existential suffering that we encounter in life, and we can't escape it. It's just going to happen, right? So he talked about the teaching of the two arrows. So the first arrow is that existential something, that existential experience. We lose someone, we lose a job or something. Then that's the pain. There's the pain of that loss. And then he said, then there's a second arrow. The second arrow, he said, is often more painful than the first. And that's what's added to, what we add to that experience. That is the conditioned response. The storylines we build up around it. The anticipation of something happening and all the things building up in our minds about it. So that, it's for me, it's not such, that word suffering, that we're, stuff happens. But it's not such a doomsday thing. It is an aliveness. It is a chance. It is a choice. And being aware of that choice in our lives, moment to moment. Then he saw in there, that the root of that, he said, is craving. Wanting through, the root of that conditioned response is very basic in this. It is craving. And I'm going to pull back just a little bit here and throw in just a Western perspective on this. Everything that he taught lines up with what we're learning from neuroscience research. Studies of the brain, the autonomic nervous system. And what it shows is, when the Buddha looked at the five aggregates, it was just happening. That's just the system functioning. There is no you in there making it function. Think about it. Are you controlling the bacteria in your gut? And all that, you know, this system is just communicating with itself and it's responding. And it's from the, you know, from now what we know, you know, we look at the autonomic nervous system, we can think of the feelings aspect, you know, the pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. Now we can think about that in terms of the fight, flight, or freeze dynamic. It's very basic, and it's that system is hundreds of millions of years old. It came about way before there was us, human beings. And like I said, that is switch is always on. It's always registering. And so in there, you know, so from that, seeing that interplay there, he saw what he called dependent origination, the conditioned nature of existence. Let me see if I remember to bring that along to. This existing that exists, this arising that arises, this not existing that no longer exists, this ceasing that ceases. That's the nature of reality. Okay? It's just these conditions exist, you exist. These conditions no longer exist, you no longer exist. And we think about all the conditions that help keep us existing. What Thich Nhat Hanh says, interbeing. And when you look in there, well, yeah, everything is impermanent. How can anything not be impermanent? So he talked about the three marks of existence, impermanence, suffering, and not self. Like I said, the nature of suffering is craving. But the basic craving in there is this clinging to self, this idea of self. So when you think about it, when you examine your thinking, you observe your thinking, you experience your thinking, every bit of thinking is in affirmation, support of, reinforcement of self. Your storyline about you. And then, you know, in our practice, we become really attuned to that. You know, according to Mike Newhall, Colvin said, you know, this, you know, we're talking about shikantaza, you know, but this is very slippery. This is very slippery. Colvin used that word slippery. And that word works for me. That selfing is very slippery. It's very sneaky. It just sort of slides in there. So you can, in your practice, in your day-to-day moment, you can be aware of the thinking and the content of the thinking and seeing what's arising in that story about that's in support of you. Unless you happen upon the, you know, the next advance in the quantum theory, that's okay. But there might be a little bit of selfing in there too. Andrew Holacek, or excuse me, Charles Janot in the book Beyond Tranquility says, the notion I weighs down all experience. The notion I weighs down all experience. You know, see that for yourself. Begin to examine that for yourself. The Buddha said, okay, I'm speaking all this, I'm telling you all this, but you don't have to believe what I say. And that's what I say now. You don't have to believe what I say. I'm just this guy from poor dirt farmers in the middle of Illinois. What do I know? But you don't have to believe what I say. Check it out. You know, for a good part of my life, I worked for newspapers. I was a reporter and editor. And one of the first things they ground into you was, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. I'd already learned that. Check it out. So maybe you're beginning to see the notion I weighs down all experience. What gets in the way? What is this? What gets in the way of intimate? It's this notion of I, fundamentally. I asserting me into the story. Gets in the way. It gets in the way of me seeing you, experiencing you without my conditioned patterns. It gets in the way of experiencing my ice cream. Because I have all of these, you know, I've been thinking all week about ice cream. Ask Judy. I've been thinking all week about ice cream. And so this is building up in here, and I'm with it, right? And it's probably my anticipation is probably going to be that ice cream is going to be much better in my anticipation than the actual thing. But still pretty good. That's how we work. It's how the insertion of something over the experience of my ice cream is just ice cream experiencing ice cream. The Buddha also said this. This is how you should train, Bahiya. In what is seen, let there be just the seen. In what is heard, let there be just the heard. In what is sensed, let there be just the sensed. In what is cognized, let there be just the cognized. Then, Bahiya, you will not be in that. When you are not in that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, then you are neither here nor there nor in between. This, just this, is the end of suffering. So as I was thinking today about, you know, what words I had left and what I was going to say, I was like, well, there are going to be a lot of beginners here, beginner mind. And how far do you take them into this not self? Well, I'm dropping you right in, folks. Because I want to give you an idea of the beauty of the practice. You know, so you come to this, you come to it looking for something. Come to Buddhism, you come to meditation seeking, right? And maybe you've read things, you know, the experience of enlightenment. Or, you know, in your lives, you're experiencing a lot of stress and anxiety or pressure. And you know, you're looking for something. You're looking how to deal with this suffering. And so there is initially, right, working with being with conditioned response to suffering. And over being with that, being with your narrative patterns, your emotional patterns, being with that, on the cushion, off the cushion. So when I teach meditation, I teach, well, what I'm teaching you now on the cushion, you can use throughout your day in your moments of pausing. You can do that. You can use it. And it's building something up. Because always remember, you're engaging in this practice, but you're not doing it. It's doing you. This practice does us. It's the practice. It's the beauty of the practice. The practice tunes us. It tunes us. Right? And in the attuning, we become more attuned. And in this process, we become more alive to the selfing. And it's working with that in your practice, the selfing. The selfing, the craving, that moment of craving. That moment of craving is setting us apart. It is sets me apart from you, me apart from this, that separation. And the more we're there in that space, we become attuned to it, and then things begin to lose their grip. We're not so much in the foreground. It's not so much about us. It may change our lives. It changed mine. I don't promote this as a practice to become more productive at work, folks. I don't. Because I know how caustic work can be. I experienced it. I take care with that. It may change your life. And if it does, hold on for the ride. It may not, but it may change how you engage in your life. That we know. It will change how you engage in all of this. But I think fundamentally, I'm going to come back to Holacek's quote. Meditation teaches us the value of every moment's unique experience. No matter how many times you've had ice cream. You have never taken in this particular lungful of air before and never will do so again. When the eye is not there, there is just this. There's just this beauty, the trees, the air, the sunlight. Feeling it in the system, you feel it. Our system is very porous, but your awareness becomes really alive to that porousness. I feel this system, not I, this system feels green. The many flavors of green, including ice cream. This particular step with its lifting, moving, and placing phases is absolutely special when you choose to attend to it carefully with your awareness. So I think we have a little time for questions. Yes.
One question is, when you were referring to the five aggregates, and then the system, are those the same? Is that the same thing?
For me, it is. Yeah. There's they're like centers of energy systems. In us, these like clusters.
And then also, thank you for I think one of your opening comments was how to be intimate with not knowing. So my question is, how can I be intimate with myself and all things and not knowing?
Ah, thank you for that question. So in the practice, I think we have to be careful, because I take care when, with the word letting go, because it quickly becomes a repressive move, pushing away. And so in practice, I encourage turning into whatever's here right now. All right. So, turning into the thinking, well, what does the thinking feel like, and the emotional pattern too with it? What does it feel like? And then you can, you begin to see what your condition, you become really familiar with your condition patterns. Which is getting in that way of, in the process, you're actually becoming intimate with what's getting in the way of being intimate. in all of this. So these patterns, they're selfing patterns, but we're turning into them. What can we learn from them? I've told this story a couple of times this week about an experience, you know, the Highland Park shooting a few years ago, because I live 8 miles from there, and we, you know, it came on the news, and we didn't know where this guy was, and we had a lot of 4th of July parades going on that were closed down, but we didn't know, you know, nobody knew where he was going to show up. And it turns out he left Highland Park and he was headed for Madison, Wisconsin for a parade there, but then he turned around and came back, and that's when he was caught. But there was this, I noticed that there was this anger, and I was feeling the energy of anger. And then it morphed into hate. And it, I experienced the hate, and it was how it felt in my body. It was really toxic. And it, I felt like I was in a room full of smokers, actually, that kind of toxic. And so I didn't want to perpetuate that in me or be projected outward. Now, I could have stuffed it, right? And then it would be there to be projected out at some other odd time. Or simmering there and festering in me and just perpetuating more hate. And then I came back into the anger, and I was in the energy of anger, and I'm okay with the energy of anger. And I ask, okay, it's always, anger is always secondary. What's underneath this? And I said, I discovered fear, and that turned into the fear, the energy of fear. And I was with it. I didn't have to do anything with it. I was just with it. It was like, there was something in there afraid. It was like, okay, I'm going to be with me, and it's afraid right now. I'm going to be with it, be with this fear. And pretty soon it shifted and went away. That's becoming intimate. That's my sense of becoming intimate with. If I hadn't danced with it, just think of the degrees of separation that would have been then perpetuated with the hate, anger and hate. Does that make sense? Thank you. Yes.
When I learn about the concept of desire craving is a root cause of suffering, initially I thought that it is a bad thing to desire to crave. But then as I contemplate more, I felt like all progress in life coming from desire. I want a better life. I want a more stable life. I want to be a better person. Because of that, I am accept that I will have to suffer through the transformation change. So that has been my mindset since I learned of that. For example, I want to achieve financial freedom, so I will go through the suffering of trying to make like promotion, trying to make more money. So I just want to know, is that the right mindset to think about desire and suffering?
I think yes. But, you know, so you're making choices here, you know, and I do, you know, investigate the, you know, the desire for material wealth. Be with that, investigate that, okay? And what's becoming of you in with that desire? Always be checking in with that, okay? You know, what you know, there is desire that brings us to this practice, okay? And it's this desire for to and you know to work with suffering. You know, and we have this chant at the end. It's you know, I vow to, the Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. That kind of desire is okay. So, but you know, other kinds of desire, investigate. And it's not that, you know, it'll throw you off your path, that it will maybe transform your expression in that path. So I talked earlier this week about our tenzo for the our sashin, Luke, and did a fabulous job, you know. But I was picking up on this, he had this directness. He was, what about Zen is direct? Zen is direct, and yeah, Zen, yeah. He has this direct quality. I have this direct quality, okay? But then in the practice, where we're, you know, it cooks us. And then, you know, I likened it to that directness now. It's still there, but in the practice, you know, I likened it to his cooking. Other flavors of Luke start to come out. Not just the directness, but other flavors of him. And he has many, he's a young guy, and he has these many different flavors, and he's cooking our food right now, by the way. And that begins to happen. So it's just not about being direct. It's just not about financial success. Then it becomes something else. You'll find your many different flavors. Thank you. So one of the things we one of the major things we talked this week about is the left-right brain dynamic. And I recommend the book Whole Brain Living by Jill Bolte Taylor. You might have heard her on YouTube. She's a neuroscientist who had a stroke and discovered what happened when her left brain shut down. So afterwards, she wrote this book about the dynamics, the qualities of left brain thinking, left brain emotional, right brain thinking and emotional, right? And there are these qualities, and it's not where we want to get rid of them, you know. But there are these qualities, like analytical mind is very left brain. And then Judy threw a wrench. She goes into this. She goes, well, she says the Buddha was very analytical. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he was. But then that analytical in this practice, like I say, many, you know, that quality doesn't go away, but other things begin to emerge. So we have these left brain qualities. And, you know, that really focuses on intelligence and finding the answers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But when we're, and I think we're, but I think we're over-oriented that way. Our culture over, you know, turns us into that, you know, starting from very early. I got to know this. And it's all about this, I got to know this. And it's really stressful. But I think the more that we, in our practice, the more the right brain is the sense of interconnection and the oneness that's always there. And when that becomes, that degree, right awareness comes on, more on board, we become, you know, our left brain qualities become smarter, I think. They take in the bigger picture and they function differently. It's beautiful. It's not either or. You know, we talk about duality and non-duality. Well, non-duality includes duality. So it's that dance. It's always that dance between form and emptiness, duality and, you know. And it's how it comes back to that tuning and attuning and how we dance in that. Yes.
You mentioned something like the second feeling. I may forgot the word, but in my understanding, it's like the conditional feeling. For example, I cut my finger yesterday while doing the kitchen stuff. That's the first pain. Then I feel like, oh, I shouldn't. I regret that I shouldn't cook today, or we should go out for dinner. So that gives me much more pain. So that's a small example, but there's every day there's this kind of second feeling which will give me more pain. So I want to know, what is your suggestion? Like right now I realize this kind of second pain, but I want to know, what is your suggestion? Like, should we just live with that, or should we get rid of this second feeling, which will make me less painful?
When you say get rid of that pain, you
like forget about it.
Well, yeah. That's creating something else.
Okay.
That's a repressing. Okay. So, you know, what you described there, you know, I sort of change it up, you know, with my clients, I change it up. So there's an experience, there's a response, and then often there's a response, the response, the response. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you cut your finger, and then there's, oh, I shouldn't have cut my finger. And then there's the other responses that you just described. Mm-hmm. And it's being with those. It's just simply being alive to them in the moment, actually. As with the, you're alive with the proliferation. And you just be with it and see what happens. So, you know, I had this experience. One of my early teaching experiences was I was at a former convent in Minnesota for a sand play therapy conference or training. And I was going into the chapel one morning, and they had these heavy wooden doors. And they closed on this, you know. And I go, oh. Now I could have gone into, you know, stop, you know, that dynamic. But I just sat down in a pew and I was with it. The proliferation stopped, okay? You know, so when you cut your finger, just sit down for a little bit and be with it. And I noticed that the quality of pain began to change. And it went away. That's the beauty of impermanence. And speaking of pain, you know, emotional or physical pain, okay, learn to soften around it. Notice what happens when there's pain. Notice when there's physical pain and emotional. Notice how the system is clenched around that experience. And in that clenching, it's actually intensifying the experience. The resisting of it, the pushing away of it is actually going to intensify it. And so if you can learn to relax the body around it, just relax around it, just be with it, and it'll go away. And all the, you know, you go back to, you know, you go back to whatever you're doing. You bandage your finger if you have to, you know. Some pain we do, you know, we may take an aspirin or something. But it's a more genuine response to our life, the many dimensions of our lives, really becoming intimate with ourselves. One more question.
Yeah. So when you talk about like the chain of feeling, like you talk about you experience like hate and then you go back to anger and then you go back to fear, how do you know that you stop at fear and then not, you know, I don't know, like,
well,
when do you know that you should stop it, that feeling?
It's, you know, I knew that, in this practice, you begin to trust, that kind of trust in the process begins to develop, okay? And so I had enough experience to know that if I turn into it and I'm not fighting it and I'm not arguing against it or anything like that, just like the pain, it'll just melt away. But it may not happen instantly, okay? Some of these experiences may take, you know, over a period of hours, days, weeks, and it's this quiet tending to, okay? But eventually you'll notice the shift. And when that shift happens, you notice what that feels like. There, you will notice something, because the conditioned reactivity will fall away, and that's what we want to get connected with. We want to know what that feels like. That's going to become our North Star. Okay, and the system will remember it. Oh, and so the system will begin to orient that way. And so you begin to trust it. And it's like, you know, little kids, right? Little kids, they fall and they scrape their knee or something. And it hurts. You know? And we just can't make a lot of pain go away. But it's how we are around it. For that little kid to know that there's somebody here who's going to be with them. And it's like that with ourselves. Okay. Well, thank you all very much today. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.